I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. For one former elementary school principal in Lenexa, it took a DUI and a hit and run to wake him up to the fact that he couldn't hide or ignore his depression. Today, learn how he's harnessing his personal story to destigmatize the condition and what the journey has taught him about navigating the mental health care system. Then, as Memorial Day approaches, we take a look inside the ritual and the rites that happens when an American service member dies. A Marine, it is said, is never left behind. We'll meet one whose job is to make sure they are escorted to their final resting place with honor and dignity. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It's been about 4 months since Corey Strothman was picked up for driving under the influence. He had driven into another car, then taken off. Normally, a hit and run like this isn't big news, but it was in Strothman's case. He was a principal of Rose Hill Elementary School in Lenexa, and when principals get DUIs, it's news. And now it's still news because, in an unusual twist, Corey Strothman wants it that way. He's battling a mental illness called major depressive disorder, and today Corey Strothman is sharing his experiences in a bid to break down the stigma of mental illness. It was that stigma that stopped him from seeking help 3 years ago when he originally was diagnosed. But now he's got a story to tell. Corey Strothman has started a blog called Grace in Your Corner, and he's considering public speaking opportunities. He joins me here in the studio now. And Corey, welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
I guess it's only fair to say that your life has taken a big turn here. How are you today?
Right now, today, I'm in a great spot. I couldn't say that back in January, but I have finally surrendered that I need extra support that I couldn't provide myself. And with that plan in place, I'm as good as you can ask, and I continue to get better every day.
I was going to say, the goal now, I guess, like it was when you were a principal, is to help people. Do I have that right?
Yeah. So looking back at my path, if I would have only just admitted to myself and came out and let people know that I was battling with these depression symptoms, I could have put everything that I have in place today back then. And I wouldn't have gone down this path of leading into a DUI, and it could have all been prevented.
So you could have stayed on as principal.
I could have stayed on as principal, a job I love and, you know, a community that I love. But what I want to do now is let people know that it's okay to speak up. We're going to break down that social stigma and the judgment, because learn from my mistakes. That doesn't have to be your story. You can get help, and the support is there. You just have to be, or to have the courage to speak up.
I was going to say, you now say point blank that your life is an open book.
Correct. Yeah.
Very different place to be than where you were.
It's a polar opposite, but I can tell you that the burden, the weight off my shoulders of not having to keep that inside is part of the reason that I am where I am today.
Huh. You were suffering from serious depression. To what extent do you have that under control today, or do you ever have something like that under control?
It will be a lifelong battle, and I'm aware of that. Just because I'm on a high today doesn't mean that down the road I'll be in the same spot. But I believe that you can manage it. And that's what I didn't do, was manage it. And that's through putting multiple support systems in place of a therapist, psychiatrist to get the right medication. When you're open about it with other people, your close support group is there to shower you with love and support and encouragement. It's all of these facets that can really help your lows not be as low and not last for as long.
And you acknowledge that you're fortunate in a sense that you can build the support network. Some people don't have that option.
That's true. I come from a very loving family and a friend group that does nothing but stand by my side. And I'm aware that that's not everyone's story. But there are groups out in the community that you can attend to, and people that are dealing with the same symptoms. And they're always welcoming people because they understand and they want to support you.
groups like NAMI and others, right?
Yeah, and if you look at different churches, and there's I attend Church of the Resurrection. On Thursday night, they have groups that focus on mental health. If you just get on and research it, there's plenty of opportunities to go out there and meet people and get the support that you want.
Yeah, I'm wondering, you know, one of your motivations here is to break down the stigma surrounding mental health. Where do you think that stigma is today? Because it seems to me that we're very much in the process of breaking that down almost day by day nationally, not just here in our neck of the woods.
It's come a long ways. It really has from where it's been in the past. I still believe that it's way too high. And quite honestly, I think that it is men that struggle the most with it because we see it as a sign of weakness. We see it as being vulnerable, and that's tough to do. And then also, part of your job might play into that. You don't want your boss or your coworkers to know that, oh, this person might be flawed or has issues. So that's where I didn't want to speak up because I was a leader of a building. And how would my community react? How would the students react? And it's scary at first. It really is.
I'm wondering how people did react once the news came out, how your students responded, how the parents responded, how your staff responded.
I wasn't around when the news broke. I was in rehab in Newton, Kansas for 18 days. Very fortunate because I think seeing all the news publications would have crushed me in the state that I was in at that point. I still don't know today how everyone has reacted. I have gotten a lot of love and support from the Rose Hill community. That means the world to me. As far as what the students know, I'm not sure how their parents explain that to them, but I just want everyone to know that I'm the same kind, loving, caring person, and I still want everyone in that community to succeed.
Corey Strothman, the former principal of Rose Hill Elementary School in Lenexa, is my guest. What were your symptoms during the past few years? How was all this affecting you?
My self-esteem was really low. It was extremely low. I felt like
even as principal of the school.
Yeah, I felt like I was inadequate. It's really weird because I was so close to my own situation, I couldn't really provide advice, but still I would meet with community members, students all the time, and I could still provide the steps that I knew needed to be taken, but I couldn't give that to myself. And so I always thought that people were judging me. When people looked at me in the eye, I just thought, well, right now they're thinking, this person doesn't know what he's doing. This person doesn't deserve to be in this job. And it started to take a toll on me at home. I would isolate, and I just was fatigued a lot.
What does that mean, you would isolate?
Isolate. I have two boys and a lovely wife at home. I wouldn't be involved in what they were doing. I would come home. I definitely wouldn't want to talk about work. I really wouldn't want to talk about anything. I just wanted to be by myself, maybe turn on the TV, escape in a sporting event or game, and just try to push through and survive and not have my mind racing about all the self-doubt that I had.
Sounds like a really difficult place to be.
Yeah, it is something that I don't wish upon anyone, and that's, again, why I speak up to say, you aren't alone. If you're experiencing that, please speak up. Please get the support you need. You'll be amazed that the judgment isn't really there that you think will be there. It'll be people wanting to give you support.
Now, your wife seemed to understand something important about mental illness, Corey, and that is you can't make someone seek help who doesn't want to help themselves. That's one of the pivotal sort of foundational beliefs in the whole mental illness field. Tell me about that.
When you need support, people around you might notice it earlier, but until the person that's actually dealing with it and has those symptoms admits it, then there's not a whole lot of good that you can do. I went to a therapist simply because at first my wife told me I needed to. My doctor had told me that I needed to.
So you went for her, not for yourself.
Absolutely. I wanted to do that to appease her, but I didn't want to go there. I didn't want to talk to a stranger about the flaws that I have in my life, which now I see aren't flaws, but opportunities to reach out and help others. But I would skip the therapy appointments at times. I would just be in denial. It was a lot of denial that, well, I can overcome this by myself. Why would I need someone else to help me? And finally, it took that DUI to realize, man, my life has plummeted. And it's because I tried it on my own and I couldn't do it. I need help, and that's okay.
Let's talk about that day in January when the bottom fell out. You were arrested for driving under the influence after you struck a car and left the scene of the accident. I know you can't say much, but what can you say about the events of that day?
Sure. It started with I was in a conference for my school in Excelsior Springs. That conference wrapped up on that Friday around noon, and I was going back to Kansas City. I had the afternoon off. I actually had a therapy appointment at 2:30. Going through my mind at that point in time was all the thoughts that I'd just been telling you about, but now it's trickled down to I was very irritable with my family members. I thought the entire world was against me now, not just the communities out there, the public, but the people closest to me that I love, because they were actually trying to help, encourage, and get me the support, but I was just mad that they didn't understand. They don't understand.
A lot of resentment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What I was doing. So after that therapy appointment, my family was coming into town that week or weekend, and I didn't want to be around them. I wanted to be by myself. One thing led to another. I made some decisions that I wish I could go back every day and change, but I can't. And it ended up with me being at the Shawnee police station, handcuffed to a bench.
How are you found? How are you identified? Can you tell us that part of it?
I was identified by the police. They pulled me over next to my house.
Okay. You resigned as principal the next day. Why so fast?
Well, there were a couple different needs here. And the first one was I realized that I need help and I can't focus on anything else. It wouldn't be fair to anyone else if I continued to try to live my professional life and my personal life. And I knew that I had taken days off before to, as I consider them, mental health days, but that was nothing more than putting a Band-Aid on it. I knew that I needed intense help that would last a long period of time. And the second part was I knew this was going to go public. I understood that the role that I was in, I was a public figure leading a building, and I love Shawnee Mission. I love Rose Hill. There's no reason, because of the things that I did, that they deserve to be brought down, because that isn't a true representation of the great things that they do there day in, day out. And I said, you know what, I can't live with myself to drag these two through the mud. I'm going to step away, try to avoid the public eye of opinion on them, and just let them focus strictly on the downfall that
so
I had.
So just end it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did you know at the moment when the police stopped you, did you know right then that your life was about to change in a really profound way?
I had no doubt that that was the case. I mean,
that's a for any human being, that's a moment, right?
Yeah, that is a true awakening. It was, I'll never forget the feeling that I had, my heart beating through my chest, knowing that I've made a lot of mistakes and I don't know how I'm going to correct them. I felt as low as you can feel. I knew that if I wanted to become the parent, the husband, the son, the professional person that I aspired to be, that I had to have a serious reconsideration of where I was heading. And I still work on that every day.
I'm wondering about those who were closest to you, Corey. Were some of them not surprised? Did you get a sense that they thought something like this might be in the offing at some point?
My closest circle, they weren't surprised. And when I say closest circle, I'm talking essentially about my parents, my brother, my sister, and my wife. Mm-hmm. They had saw me slowly decline. They had seen me not be the same person, the enthusiastic, joyful person that I'd been.
Right.
As far as for other friends, the community, you know, they haven't told me differently, but I think it was a surprise to them. I did my mm-hmm. best to hide and mask my symptoms. Depression can be an invisible disease.
I was going to say, it's amazing what all of us can do to, when it comes to hiding stuff from other people.
Yeah, and
that's sort of how most people roll in a lot of ways, right?
No one wants to show a chink in their armor. Mm-hmm. Everyone wants to be that perfect person that you see out there with the picture of the smiles on social media. But again, it's okay to have flaws. It's how life is, and you're never going to conquer life on your own.
How long have you been an educator?
I have been in education for 10 years.
And becoming a principal, was that something that was a career goal?
It was. I didn't realize it at first. I started in the path of education because my mother is in education. She was actually my fifth grade teacher. And then I graduated from Kansas State. I went to Kansas City, which was a big change for me. I'm from a small town. And I started teaching fourth grade, and I had 24 to 25 kids.
What school?
I started at Rising Star Elementary School, which is also in Shawnee Mission. It's fairly close to Rose Hill. And after a couple years, I was like, I love making the impact on these kids and these families, but how can I get my hand in the bigger picture? So I then set my goal to become a principal. I went to Baker University and got my master's, and the opportunity came knocking at on my door at the age of 28, and I jumped right into it.
Hmm. And the fact you're leaving this behind is got to be, again, pretty dramatic.
It's something that I haven't came to terms to yet, honestly. Mm-hmm. It is a big part of my life. It will always be a big part of my life. But the door to education is closed at the time, and understandably so. But that's the one aspect of life that I'm not exactly sure where I'm heading.
Why is that understandably so? Why can't you ever go back? I mean, assume you get help, you move on with your life. Why should that door be closed forever?
Well, I believe in second chances, and I don't think the door is closed forever. Mm-hmm. But I have spoken to most districts around the KC metro area, and the feedback's pretty similar that they're worried, really, and I'm saying this, not them, but to me, they're worried about my story being out there and the spotlight it puts on their district of employing someone that got a DUI. But again, in life, I think there's opportunity to make mistakes, and it's not about the mistake you made. It is about how you react and how you overcome that adversity. Mm-hmm. And that's the path I'm on right now. If someone would want to give me the opportunity, I know that I have the skill set. I've experienced a lot of success in my career, but I can't control what employers think.
But you've made a choice here, Corey. You've decided to come on this show. You've decided to speak on local TV and talk about this issue very openly, maybe at the possible expense of seeing your education career delayed for some period of time.
Yeah, and when I weighed the pros and the cons of truly opening up my life and exposing not only my weaknesses, but allowing my family to be vulnerable, I just always think back to the path that I went down, the way I felt, and how I think, and I truly believe in my heart that I can help others avoid that. And that goes back to my educational background. I can help people and help them understand and gain the courage to speak out. And that's exactly what I'm doing with Grace in Your Corner, is I'm telling my life story about all the stresses and experiences that I've had. I'm not a professional, but learn from my mistakes and get the support that you need. Mm-hmm. And if that's a sacrifice of my career, you know, I guess that is what's going to happen.
What kind of response are you getting?
I've been getting a really good response. I've had people reaching out that are close to me. I've had a lot of people reaching out that have mentioned that they are dealing with some sort of mental health in their family. Others have reached out and said, listening to your story, it describes a lot of the symptoms that I have in my life. Mm-hmm. And that just warms my heart to know that it's making an impact. And I can truly tell you, I am on a mission here, and I'm going to continue to promote my website, and it's going to be something that isn't just mental health. It could be addiction. It could be any of life stressors and ways that we can manage through together.
Remind people what your website is again.
Yeah, it's graceinyourcorner.com. Mm-hmm. And it is, I want everyone to be clear that, again, I'm not a professional. I have resources on there that you can seek professional help, but you can gain experiences, you can gain opinions, and it's just really a way to connect with others. I hope for it to be self-running, where people are coming, they're opening, they're sharing more, and we can learn from each other exactly how to take on life's challenges.
You know, one thing that you've talked about, and it's interesting to me, is just how difficult the mental health system is to navigate, Corey. There are resources out there, yes, but knowing how to access it, knowing where to go, finding a therapist you can connect with and feel comfortable sharing with, all of that is a puzzle that's really hard for people to put together.
It's extremely difficult.
Yeah.
I was fortunate to have my wife, who was somewhat familiar with it because of the background that she has. But without her, I would have been lost. I wouldn't have known where to start. I wouldn't have known the connections to make. And then the frustrating point is, I'm in this moment of despair. And in the mental health world, it's not always that timely. It mm-hmm. takes time. Sometimes where you're going, they might not have availability for you, and you're seeking out help. You're in crisis mode, and that pains my heart too. And I've talked to people that are in similar spots since I've gone through all this, and they've told me they didn't have a bed, they didn't have a room, and they didn't know what to do. And that is difficult to hear.
And that's a big problem that needs to be solved.
Absolutely. We look at many problems. I often refer to it as comparing it to if you break off a tooth or something of that, your dentist is going to work you in, right? We're not going to let there and have you suffer. This is even more important than that. But yet we still don't have a solution. We're making gains, but I think we need to put our heads together and find out a way how we can expand mental health across the country.
An appointment to see somebody in July today isn't going to do anybody a lot of good sometimes. You know, it's a long time down the road.
Right. We're talking about suicide too. I mean, some of these people have suicidal thoughts. Some people, you know, are not stable at all. Mm-hmm. And you're going to tell them to stay home for a month by themselves?
Yeah.
That's scary.
That's Corey Strothman. Again, his blog is titled Grace in Your Corner. He's a former principal of Rose Hill Elementary School out in Lenexa. He's sharing his important story about his DUI and the aftermath, his dealing with major depressive disorder. Corey, thanks for coming in and sharing your story. We wish you the best of luck and hope you'll stay in touch with us, okay?
Yeah, absolutely, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Time for a break. When we come back, how the Marines handle the loss of life and the loss of a soldier and the rituals that take place in the aftermath of a death. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday in the show, a retail system that would limit government's role in healthcare. Learn about the model that could make it more patient-specific and affordable. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, as abortion restrictions are levied in states across the country, including Missouri, we'll look at the data for an understanding of why one in four women in this country might be faced with the decision to terminate a pregnancy. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, in the military, they're called the Casualty Assistance Calls Officer, the Marine in charge of notifying next of kin when a fellow Marine is killed in action. They are the service member that no family wants to encounter. The job of a Casualty Assistance Call Officer is highly ritualized. It involves notifying next of kin and dealing with logistics and all kinds of paperwork. Another service member may remain with the body overnight. A Marine, it is said, is never left behind. Now, a conversation just before Memorial Day with a Kansas City Marine who's done this work. With us is Gunnery Sergeant Roger Ruiz, who happens to be the husband of Up to Date intern Liz Ruiz. Gunnery Sergeant, nice to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Is this a job that any Marine wants, or do you have a choice?
It could definitely be a mixture of emotions. As far as if you knew the person, you will have, sometimes they'll volunteer. They're not always allowed to, because upon delivery of the notification, you know that sometimes the family will push blame on the individual that's delivering this news. So you don't necessarily want it, because you're getting ready to change somebody's whole world.
You're changing their world forever.
Yes, sir.
In a flash, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. You know, when someone dies in the Marine Corps, there's lots of moving parts, Gunnery Sergeant. Well, walk us through what takes place, because just a whole lot happens here.
Yes. So initially, after, the Marine is confirmed that, he's deceased and passed away, the headquarters Marine Corps will contact the closest unit to the primary next of kin, and they will be the one that will then be tasked to deliver the notification.
And this has to happen fairly rapidly in some cases?
Yes. So upon notification, usually they'll give you a very detailed timeline of where you need to be, when you need to be there, and the steps that you're going to take. So notifications are usually done between 5 a.m. and midnight.
I was going to say, there are certain set hours, exceptions made for those hours outside that window, but sometimes you're showing up at 11:45 p.m., right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. A lot of it goes into, just like I said, the details that Headquarters Marine Corps wants you, because sometimes, unfortunately, there's multiple notifications that are going on. And when you're talking about multi-states, different time zones, it may be 11:45 here, but if the other next of kin is located in California, they definitely want to get both of the notifications done at the same time, so that way it's
there's no surprises to someone who's not been notified.
Yes,
yeah.
Sir.
So off you go.
Yes,
right,
sir.
At a moment like that. What else is happening when this news comes down the pike?
So depending upon, the situation, sometimes it's not always, unfortunately, KIAs, killed in action. Sometimes it's, motorcycle accidents or car accidents, or again, unfortunately, it's suicide. So depending upon the type of, the death, that can change the steps and the process and what's actually going on.
Is this only for Marines, or is it for any branch of the military?
Every branch has the notification. Mm-hmm. Every branch will notify their service members. Family.
But the Marines have a set of rituals that might be a little distinct onto themselves, right?
I'm not too sure. I don't know. I've never really talked to any of the other branches as far as their process. So I'm not too sure if theirs is different from ours, or if there's any difference at all.
One part of all this is escorting the body the entire time the body is being taken to the hometown or the site of where the burial is going to be. What is that about? Why is the body always accompanied by someone?
So like you said, the Marines, we have a lot of mottos, and one of them is, you never leave a Marine behind. You never leave a fallen Marine behind. So that is just us ensuring that, we're taking care of that Marine all the way up until, his final resting place, and showing the family that, the Marine Corps is still here supporting. And, you build a bond, when you go through recruit training, and, as you're going through the Marine Corps and just your job, you build a bond. And it may not even be somebody you know, but mm-hmm. you still feel, a sense of pride and just the belonging to want to be there, to stand next to the Marine and, just be there with them the entire time, or she.
I just watched a film last night on HBO Now featuring Kevin Bacon playing the part of a Marine who does this job of escorting the body to a hometown, I think out in Wyoming, for the burial. And what was interesting about the film, Gunnery Sergeant, was this notion that as the movie progressed, the Marine played by Kevin Bacon, he's a colonel, I think, he really gets to know the deceased member of the fellow Marine and gets to a real sense of who this person was and develops an attachment here that was just unmistakable. And I'm wondering if you've had that experience as well.
I have. I've actually done a part of an escort for a very good friend of mine. He was killed in action in Afghanistan, and I became his escort from Dover Air Force Base to Arlington National Cemetery. Mm-hmm. So I have taken part in that. And like I said, for me, it was a great honor, for one, for his wife to ask me, you know, to do that because I really wanted to, but I didn't want to, you know, interject myself on on her.
But she invited you.
She did. She reached out and she asked me, and I was very, very honored to be able to do that.
Now, what surprised you about that escorting that maybe you hadn't anticipated before?
Just the whole the feeling of it. You know, it was a pretty long car ride from Dover to Arlington, and. You know, for me, like I said, it was very personal. He's my very good friend. And, you know, the fact that I was sitting in the front seat and he was in a car with me, you know, and just being there in that moment and, you know, kind of knowing where we were headed and what we were getting ready to do. Mm-hmm. It was a very rough, experience.
You know, again, hearkening back to the movie I just watched last night, there was a sense that the Kevin Bacon character, as long as the body was moving, was in transport, that was something that was a little easier to deal with. As soon as the movement stopped and the burial and the memorial service began, then the reality of what had occurred sunk in a way that maybe hadn't before. Was that ring a bell with you?
Absolutely, because you're still in somewhat of a denial. You know, you're just like,
of
this
course.
this can't be happening. You know, for my case, I had just talked to him, my good friend, you know, not long before, you know, it happened. And for me, I was in denial all the way up until, and I just kind of, you know, I would talk to him periodically on the car ride and, you know, just kind of hoping for something, and maybe, you know, that wasn't right, and they, you know, this wasn't actually happening. And then actually getting there and seeing everybody lined up and, you know, the actual funeral part, that's when it drove itself home that this is happening. This is what, you know, what we're getting ready to do. So,
you know, I'm just wondering how difficult of a position this is for an active Marine to be this escort, because you aren't supposed to show emotion. People don't expect Marines to show emotion. And here you are in the car with your very good friend escorting him to his final resting place. And I imagine you're just fighting it inside as you went through that day.
Absolutely. And even like I said, with the, you know, even delivering the notification, you know, like I said, just being in the Marine Corps and, you know, you got your brothers and sisters, you may not have known them, but you know what they went through. You know the pride that they have and you know the pride that the family has. And, you know, sometimes the family, and obviously they handle it in different ways. So, you know, they tell you, you know, when you're getting ready to deliver the notification, you want to take it inside. You don't want to ever do anything at the door. But some people won't let you in the door.
Yeah.
They don't want it to, because, like I said, that if you're not inside and you're not telling them, then it's not like it's not happening. It didn't happen. So it's a very difficult experience and the process is very, very, there's no script. You can't write a script to it. Mm-hmm. Because like I said, everybody's different. You're going to get different reactions. Some handle better than others. And you know, you can't account for, you know, the same thing.
Well, let's talk about that. But let me just first reintroduce you here. Gunnery Sergeant Roger Ruiz is my guest. We're talking about this ritual that Marines go through when a fellow Marine is killed in action or killed otherwise, and sort of the steps Marines take to lay a fallen soldier to rest here. You know, if I understand right, Gunnery Sergeant, you've notified next of kin just once. Can you tell us what happened there when you arrived at the house and how you bore yourself up to deliver that news?
So, I wasn't there for the initial notification. I did everything. I was actually, I wasn't able to make the notification. So I did not do that part. But everything following that I was there for, it was kind of like you could kind of see the same thing. You know, we'd park out front and walking up to the door, you could kind of just see the family having to relive that initial notification all over again. It's kind of like, you know, you're back again, probably with more bad news, or, you know, just...
But you were going back up there because you had issues to deal with, the burial service to sort of formalize and paperwork to deal with. And so there were a number of return trips.
Yes, sir. There's a lot of administrative things that go along with it. You know, just like I said, if it's an out-of-state casualty, you know, you got to coordinate with the airport. And, you know, then you got to let the family know, hey, this is, you know, when the flight's arriving. So there's a lot of paperwork and... you know, the benefit, the death benefits that the family gets, you got to take that paperwork back to see them. So you're making multiple trips out to see the family through this entire process to coordinate with them. And they, you know, pick where the funeral is going to go, what cemetery. So you got to get them to sign, you know, that part of the paperwork. And, you know, just like I said, the whole receiving of the property, you know, you got to go back out there and have them sign that piece of the paperwork. So you go out there and you see, you kind of build a relationship. At first, you know, it's a bit rough and not all of them end well, but, you know, throughout the process, sometimes, you know, you really do build a relationship with these families.
I was going to say, at first you're a stranger and then you become something else, right?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. You know, it's kind of you give them your cell phone number and you have, hey, if you have any questions at any point in time, please, by all means, call me. And, you know, you're there. You're that piece. You're there to help them too. You know, get through this process and start the healing process and stuff like that. So you definitely make yourself available for them.
Yeah, I'm wondering about this particular family and at what point they wanted to know more about how their fallen son, is a son in this case?
Yes, yes.
How their fallen son had died.
So the when the initial event happens, the Marine Corps. They do an investigation, whether it's they know, or like I said, you know, from a killed in action to a car crash and anything, the Marine Corps is going to launch an investigation in this. And then, so you actually do not provide the family with so many details. You know, you definitely give them some, but you don't want to tell them something that's incorrect.
So that's a very important standard the Marines lay forth, that if you don't know the answer to a question, I was watching a video about this last night, you don't answer the question.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And you just let them know that if they have any questions, you can just say, hey, I will definitely call, you know, and see what I can find out for you. And then eventually there's the report that comes out, you know, the autopsy and the casualty report will come out, and then that is released to the family.
In this particular case, was the soldier killed in action?
No, unfortunately, the Marine had committed suicide.
Oh, okay. And that changes, everything.
Yes, sir, it does.
Yeah.
So like I said, the family kind of knew about it because it was obviously some of his friends found him, and, you know, they contacted a family along with the unit, and then the unit started making the phone calls to Headquarters Marine Corps and to get it actually tasked out for the CAECO process to start.
Mm-hmm.
So the family kind of already knew. And unfortunately, you know, we get a lot with social media nowadays. There's a lot of times where you're, like I said, you're going to deliver a notification and the family already knows.
Hmm. Boy, that's got to be hard, too. In this case, were you able to help the family understand a little more about why the soldier had committed suicide?
So the Marine, he was having some problems and just so like I said, the family was kind of already aware of that, mm-hmm. That he was having he's going through some stuff. And unfortunately, it was just too much for him.
Yeah. OK. Gunnery Sergeant Roger Ruiz is my guest. We're talking this morning about the ritual that Marines go through when a fellow Marine dies in one manner or another. If you want to join our conversation here before this coming Memorial Day, 816-235-2888 is our phone number, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. I'm wondering, again, watching these films last night, when a Marine arrives at a home to deliver the notification, you are supposed to get inside the home. Why is that thought to be so important?
So you want to go inside because you want to start trying to not control the environment, but you definitely want to make sure that person, you can be there in case they decide they want to try to do something. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, sometimes you'll have people who will get upset, and if it's if they are able to maybe get to their significant other, they may try to leave, or they may try to get in a car and take off. Mm-hmm. You know, so you definitely want to bring them inside so that way you can sit down, you know, and for
what do you do if they want to hop in the car and take off?
You you try, you know, you try to get them to not, and then you try to, you know, just continue to tell them that, you know, they need to be there so you can help them, you know, with the process. And as far as, you know, start going through, you know, what's going to kind of happen mm-hmm. and stuff. But with the initial shock and awe, it sometimes definitely can be a very, very difficult task to just get inside the door.
Mm-hmm. You know, I know I don't mean to pound on this too much, but it's such an interesting moment. Are you instructed as to what you're supposed to say in those first few sentences that are so critical, Gunnery Sergeant?
There is. There's information that's sent out, and it kind of, because like I said, you don't really know too much yourself. You know that a Marine unfortunately has passed away, and you're going to deliver the notification. So there is somewhat of a script that they give you to help you. Because some people, you know, it's not easy to talk to a stranger, or it's not easy to say something. So they kind of give you
not something like this.
Yes, sir. They try to give you a script or a dialogue to stay as close to as possible. Maybe not verbatim, if you can say it verbatim, but you know, to give you something to guide you to be able to deliver this the news.
I'm imagining that that's not a script you ever want to deliver.
Not at all. And of that, and then as you know, part of my duty here in Kansas City is also we do a lot of funerals in general. So between, unfortunately, that part, that script, and then, you know, the script that we give when we're actually conducting a military funeral, giving military honors to a service Marine who's passed away. Those are two phrases that I hope I never have to say once I leave here.
Yeah, I'm wondering, as you work through your number of visits to the family of the Marine who had committed suicide, how that relationship evolved and sort of where you left it by the time of the funeral.
So when we first started, like I said, it was definitely very cold. You know, they didn't really, there wasn't a whole lot of conversation going on. It was you asked the questions because they, like I said, they were just kind of in disbelief. They couldn't say anything. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, obviously towards the end, you know, they would open the door before we knocked on the door, and they would, you know, they would invite us in instead of us asking to come in. You know, they would offer us something to drink if we needed anything.
Did you go by yourself, or are you with another?
No,
another
you, Marine? You do not go by yourself. There's always at least two Marines that go.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
Just again, you never leave a Marine behind. You're never alone. So, and there's just like I said, just for assistance, for help. You know, in case there's multiple people in the house, and you know, like I said, they try to, you know, leave. Well, you don't want to go running out of the house with, you know, if it's the mom or the dad and they try to hop in their car, well, maybe there's a younger child that's still in the house, but they're emotional and they're not really thinking about that. They're just trying to get to their, you know, their loved one. So you definitely don't go alone.
Let's go to some phone calls here at 816-235-2888. Or again, you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Dave from Kansas City, Missouri. You're on with Gunnery Sergeant Roger Ruiz. Dave, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for your service, Gunnery Sergeant.
Thank you for your support.
My father was a Guadalcanal Marine, and he died at age 83 of cancer in hospice. But the Marine Corps came and conducted a funeral in his church, and we were very impressed and very thankful. My mother got a flag from one of the fellows who said...
Dave, there's a lot of wind blowing. Can you get somewhere where there's not so much wind?
Is that better?
I think so. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Anyway, the service was entailed presenting my mother with a flag from the Commandant of the Marine Corps and the President of the United States, the playing of taps, and she didn't want a 21-gun salute. So that was, we were well appreciative of the Corps, and Dad left them a bunch of money for Toys for Tots.
Yeah.
Anyway, I wanted to say thanks.
Yes.
To the Marine Corps.
Yeah, tell us about some of those kinds of details, Gunnery Sergeant, this notion of the kinds of things that take place during a service that you talk with a family about, the 21-gun salute.
Sure. There. You know, when the at the funeral, we always make sure to position ourselves prior to the arrival of the procession. Upon there, we, you know, we render honors on with the entry, and then
meaning salutes.
Yes, sir. There's a if there's a rifle detail, they will perform a rifle salute or present arms, and then there's also the hand salute that for the person who are not holding weapons. Then they moved into usually the they will do a small service, say, you know, something to bring the last little bit of the family together, and then they'll turn it over to us for military honors. If it's a casket, the Marines will march up to the casket. They'll render a hand salute. They'll display the flag, and then that's when the rifle volleys will begin. Then from there, taps will play, and upon the last note of taps, the Marines will then fold the flag, and they'll check it over, make sure that it's, you know, nice and smooth and everything is crisp. The Marine march off, and the Marine presenting will then go to the family and kneel down, and they'll present that flag to the next of kin.
And you've got to be an absolute rock not to be moved by all of that. It's moving just hearing you describe it. And again, watching it in the film last night, my father-in-law was a Marine, and I lived through exactly what you're describing. You know, what's your normal job in the Marine Corps? Because you do a lot of other things too.
I do. So I'm the regimental mess chief, which means I'm part a cook, a short, easy way to say it. I'm also the equal opportunity representative for my unit, kind of like an HR. Mm-hmm. I'm the substance abuse control officer, which is, you know, for drugs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And sometimes I just fill in as the company gunnery sergeant, so kind of like a head supervisor.
So you're position. A jack of all trades.
I am,
with this being one of your duties when that terrible moment arises.
Yes,
then.
Sir. Yes. Sir. Well, it's, I mean, for the most part, with the CAECO, you know, it is. There's some of the requirements have to be, you have to at least be a staff non-commissioned officer, so the rank of E6. And then we try to, you know, spread it out, because mm-hmm. it's very taxing on you emotionally and physically, because you, like I said, you kind of become a part of that family and what they're going through. So we definitely, you know, try to spread it out to make sure that the same Marine is not having to continuously go and do the same notifications and,
right.
you know, go through this experience over and over and over again.
Well, that's Gunnery Sergeant Roger Ruiz describing these rituals that the Marines go through when a fellow Marine is killed. And Gunnery Sergeant, thanks so much for taking some time with us today and walking us through that. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow, music comes in all different genres, and everyone has their own definition of what's good. We delve into the science that explains why you love the music you do. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.